This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney.
This is something that they have to work on. I don't intend to browbeat them or, you know, I'm going to encourage them every step of the way, and I hope that this committee will encourage them every step of the way.
Governor Casey calls for tightening up Ohio's gun laws. Now it's up to the legislature. Also on today's show, discussions continue over where to build a new soccer stadium for FC Cincinnati. And we'll get an update on flooding in the Cincinnati area. How much damage has it caused? First up, Newport has cleared the way for a needle exchange program in northern Kentucky, and Hamilton County is considering a pre-jail diversion program for people addicted to heroin. Joining us to discuss these stories are WCPO.com reporter Lisa Bernard-Kuhn. Good afternoon, Lisa.
Thanks for having me.
And WVXU reporter Ann Thompson. Hi, Ann.
Hi, Mark. Thanks for having me.
You can join us at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. So, Lisa, let's start with the idea of the pre-jail diversion program. They have overcrowding at the Hamilton County Jail. They've had a spike in inmates who are addicted to drugs, so they're looking at this idea of pre-arrest diversion. What is that? How does that work?
Yeah, so these programs have been popping up across the country, and essentially it's about making sure that folks who are really struggling with addiction or mental health disorders and who are committing maybe some lower level crimes, getting them the help that they need so that they're not cycling and recycling through the criminal justice system. So rather than arrest them, put them in jail and sort of clog up the system, get them the help they need in a behavioral health setting or an addiction treatment setting. And the programs elsewhere have been showing some pretty good signs of success that it keeps these folks from sort of recommitting crimes that, again, get them into the criminal justice system in the first place.
So what are some of the other places around the country that have these programs in place?
Yeah, Seattle was an early adopter, Albany, New York, some places in Massachusetts, you know, even Atlanta, Georgia, there's been some success there. And what I'm told by the folks here in Hamilton County, they're in the very early stages of exploring this, is what's great about these programs is you can sort of cater it to a community's need. You know, what is it that they're really wrestling with now in terms of the lower level criminal behavior that they're really trying to wrestle down? So some communities focus on prostitution, you know, getting folks involved in prostitution, the help that they need so they're not cycling back through the system. You know, even crimes of poverty, right? So you think about somebody who's homeless, who's continually cited for trespassing or panhandling. You know, what can you do for that individual that keeps them out of the criminal justice system?
So they've seen reductions in repeat offenders. Are there cost savings associated with programs like this?
Yeah, we're told that there are. You know, one source that I cited in the story that I wrote, there was a program in Texas that reported a $2.4 million savings in jail costs tied to just public intoxication. So they were working with this portion of the public that were committing repeat, you know, public intoxication crimes, if you will, and putting them into treatment. You know, there's a question about, so you see the savings on the jail side. How do the costs shift across the system? What does it look like? What are the costs on the behavioral health and the addiction treatment side? We're told that it costs less to treat someone in those settings versus the criminal justice system, because if you think about what's involved in the criminal justice system, you're tying up a police officer's time that has a cost to it, possibly an attorney's time, court costs, et cetera. Those are all pretty taxing on public resources. So I couldn't find any hard numbers around that cost shift, but it seems anecdotally, at least, that you would see some savings.
And it seems kind of like we've been moving in that direction. For example, at the Hamilton County Jail, they had instituted for the women some kind of a test program where they would be in a certain cell altogether and trying to recover.
That's right. And, you know, Hamilton County has been advocating and trying to lobby for more money to do more things like this. They call them, I think, treatment pods, right? So that I think the last that I heard out of Hamilton County, they were trying to nail down about a $3 million grant to expand that program to at least up to 80 beds. And they've seen some success, you know, they've seen good success out of that program. Again, the point of it being, how do we make sure that these individuals get the help they need now so that they're not back in here having committed the same kind of crimes that are tied to the addiction, right? So the low-level crimes that someone commits, theft from autos, you know, stealing at a retailer, all of the things that somebody who's sort of, you know, struggling with addiction will do just to cover the cost of their daily habit.
Does this help with police community relations? Has that been noticed in the other communities that have tried this?
You know, I talked to Tom Fallon here in Hamilton County. He's leads the Hamilton County Heroin Task Force law enforcement arm there. And he said that's the thing that stands out to him the most is that there's a real benefit to and a real, you know, possible improvement on community police relations. Because if you think about what that officer is doing at that moment, they're helping that person. They're assisting them with something that maybe they really have wanted for a long time and need, rather than putting handcuffs on them, forcing somebody to maybe make that decision about posting, you know, bond, bail, et cetera. And so you can see sort of that payoff could happen pretty quickly there for that relationship.
So what prompted local officials to start trying to find details? I mean, it wasn't just the models that they were seeing around the country. There was something actually going on locally, wasn't there?
Yeah, and I think it was a couple of different pieces, right? So we have the quick response teams that have been started up in Coleraine Township and Norwood. And these are the teams that go out after someone has overdosed. You know, there's a law enforcement, there's an officer involved, there's a first responder involved, you know, on the EMS side, there's addiction treatment services counselor involved, and they go review the last week's worth of overdoses. They go to those individuals who they can find and say, hey, you just recently overdosed, meaning you essentially died. We're here to help you take the next step to get help with your addiction if you're ready. They've seen a lot of success with that. And so as they, you know, as officials looked at how do we expand that program and how do we see more success out of that, they started hearing about these other pre-arrest diversion programs that really move them upstream more, right? So rather than wait till somebody overdoses, you know, how do we get to those individuals more quickly? So maybe it's on this, you know, further upstream on the you know, they're creating or they're committing these lower level crimes and getting in touch with them that way.
So how much support is there for doing this?
I think that's the question. I think that part of the effort right now, and Interact for Health is helping lead the exploratory piece of this. It's about making sure they understand who the stakeholders are that they need to bring to the table. There's more than 45 law enforcement agencies in Hamilton County, so making sure that they're able to bring everyone up to speed with that, and trying to figure out where does a program like this live? Is it a county program? Does some other agency own all of this or a piece of this? And because they're in those early stages, I think the questions too about support are still being answered. Certainly the Hamilton County Commission, from as we understand it, supports it. This is a program that Denise Driehaus has talked about. She also leads the Hamilton County Heroin Task Force or Coalition. So we know that there is some support at that level. It's just sort of the mechanics of getting all these other, you know, municipalities on board.
Ultimately, would they need the Hamilton County Commission's approval to start this program, Lisa?
You know, I think yes, but I think it's too soon to say who are going to be the lead decision makers on this. You know, the sheriff is certainly going to be involved in some level. These other police agencies are going to be involved in some level. And again, Interact for Health is really taking the lead and figuring out, and they'll be paying for a consultant to sort of map out what this program could look like here, how could it be most effective? And once they have some of those answers, then I think they would then take it to those, you know, decision makers who would maybe pay for other portions of it or need to support it.
So is there any kind of timeline in place? Has anybody said we'd like to have this going by a certain date? Or
I asked that question a lot, and I was told many times it's still wait and see. We have to figure out what this program could look like for us before we really try to nail down a time frame. But there's a lot of optimism around the success that they're seeing, elsewhere in the country. And so I think you'll hear people rallying around that as they start to build the pieces here.
Now, Ann, Newport City Commission this week approved starting a needle exchange program. Now, this is in response to the HIV cluster they've been monitoring in Northern Kentucky.
Exactly. There is some concern that we could repeat what had happened in Indiana, in Austin, Indiana, where there was actually an outbreak. And in Northern Kentucky, they have not determined whether or not there's an outbreak, but they're trying to.
They
have a cluster.
Okay.
And so as of February 21st, the health department says that 43 people tested positive for HIV, and 20 of those were reporting injection drug use as a risk factor. And so what's happening now is they are conducting in-depth interviews with those people that come in, and they have genetic testing underway to see if they're infected with the same strain. And they hope to come to some kind of determination in connection with the CDC and also the state in the next couple of weeks, I think.
So where will this exchange be located?
All right. Well, in Newport, it will be located at the St. Elizabeth Urgent Care in South Newport. And Lisa, I don't know if you know about Covington and Kenton County, but those are places where they had approved having a needle exchange program, but they had to wait until there was some provision until like another place comes on board.
And in other words, Newport.
That's
yeah,
right.
Yeah. And there was a lot of discussion around should there be a mobile van? And I'm not sure, meaning a van that would travel from location to location in Northern Kentucky. I don't know what the final call was on that, if that's still being explored. But that's possibly in the mix, I think.
And you also mentioned that it's ongoing in Grant County, and they are seeing some
How successful has
positive
that been?
Grant County was the first, the first place in Northern Kentucky to really take up this program. And so they've been tracking numerous metrics around this. The goal is to get individuals in to do the needle exchange process. Then you offer other medical services, testing for HIV, other infectious diseases. Then you also, try to wrap other services around them by asking questions like, are you ready for treatment at this time? And so they've really been keeping track of those who are going into treatment. At the end of 2017, out of the Grant County program, almost 130 folks had gone into a treatment program, and they're really thrilled about that number.
And Mark, the health department was trying to put some pressure to start these needle exchange programs. I went to a news conference in January, and the health district director, Dr. Sadler, was saying that she suspects that there are many more drug users infected with HIV than they have determined. And she said, all of us know somebody who knows someone, whether it's in your family, in your church, whether it's in your neighborhood that's infected with HIV and is a drug user. And even the president of St. Elizabeth was there calling for needle exchange programs.
So they're continuing to monitor and test for possible HIV cases.
Yes, and trying to determine if, in fact, there's an outbreak or, cluster, and then trying to get help, as Lisa was mentioning, for these people.
What are the testing locations, Ann? Where are they doing the testing?
Well, Mark, I believe you can find that online with the health department. I think I had a link to my story about that.
Okay.
Yeah. At the needle exchange site, right? So, at the St. Elizabeth location that's been mentioned, that's where they do it. So when somebody comes in, it's sort of this spectrum of services that are offered at that time.
Lisa, how many programs do we have in the area now?
They are growing, which is a good sign for those who have really been advocating for this. One thing I wanted to say is it was considered a real win for the Newport location, for those folks who have been working for years to get that site up and running. In the Ohio side of the river, we had four locations already running by the newly created Exchange Project, which was an extension of the Cincinnati Exchange Project. They've just added a Claremont County location at Mercy Health Hospital out in Claremont and Batavia. They're working hard to get an Anderson location up and running, so that would, take you up to six. Now with the Newport locations, we're looking at, 8 plus. So, and we're told that they at least in Southwest Ohio, they're not ready to stop at those numbers. They want to expand to the east side. They want to, or I'm sorry, further to the west side. They want to another location north of the city to serve sort of that Coleraine Township area. So we're going to keep hearing a lot about the work to expand this kind of program.
Let's take a call now. Charles joins us. Hi, Charles. Go right ahead.
Hello.
Hi, Charles. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I'm with the Faith Community Alliance. We've been following this for about a decade. I want to congratulate you on the meal exchange program. I'm attached to, my church is attached to one over in Mount Auburn. The problem that I'm seeing is the fact that outside of what I'm hearing here, you don't usually hear the discussion about the AIDS component. I mean, with the epidemic has sort of been existing for a while anyway, and now it may be blowing up, but people want to segment the issue between addiction or the use of needles and the HIV. And the other problem that I've seen over the years is because of the cost of care and concern that we don't really have a very strong triage system where people who need something more than case management or counseling, more like hospitalization, that's been eroded for the last 20 years. So it's an uphill fight. I think what they're doing is wonderful, but it's still something that needs to be discussed in the public forum much more than I think public policy is allowing at this time.
Charles, thank you.
Yeah, you know, one thing that you, over the years in covering the issue, you certainly heard frustration from folks in public health as they've called for more needle exchanges. There's a lot of frustration that it's taken an outbreak-ish, right, in mm-hmm. HIV and hepatitis C to get sort of the political motivation to agree to this and expanding these sites. And so you see other communities right now still wrestling about whether or not they want an exchange in their backyard. Again, we were discussing, some people see it as enabling, but public health officials say this is really preventing infectious, deadly diseases, and we need to do more.
Lisa, thank you, and Ann, thank you, too. WCPO.com reporter Lisa Bernard-Kuhn and WVXU reporter Ann Thompson. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney, along with WCPO.com government and political reporter Amanda Seitz. Hi, Amanda.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you. And WVXU City Hall reporter Jay Hanselman. Hi, Jay.
Hi, Mark.
You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at WVXU.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. So, Amanda, with FC Cincinnati, a lot of the attention lately has been on the West End, everybody, because it's like, well, that must be where they're thinking of locating their stadium. It doesn't seem to be the case now. It seems like they've shifted again, or am I?
Well, basically, the latest with FC Cincinnati is we still don't know if they're going to get into the MLS, and we still don't know where they're going to put a stadium if they even do get into the MLS. So we continue to be on this watch to see if they get the bid. And meanwhile, it seems as if Jeff Birding is continuing to go to meetings now in several of the locations between Oakley, Newport, and the West End to talk about, I know he's meeting with the Oakley Community Council, for example, on Monday. So he seems to be making the rounds again with all the stadium sites. So it's hard to read between the tea leaves at this point.
Well, and he met with Newport's business community recently, didn't he?
Yeah, he did that this week. He has the traffic study coming out for Oakley. I'm told that it's completed, and that's what we'll be getting a presentation on Monday from FC Cincinnati to see how that would go. But he continues to also be in the West End as well. They're having like a meet and greet, for example, on, I believe it's Sunday, with some West End community members. So we really don't know at this point what all that means.
Do you know what kind of reaction you got from Newport?
I was not there. Okay. I think based on the Cincinnati Business Courier article that I read, he got a very warm welcome there. So that's must be a nice reprieve after all the West End meetings that we've seen, where there's been some residents and even people who don't live in the West End that have expressed some major concerns about a stadium there.
Probably significant this week was the fact that a city council committee and the school board actually held a joint meeting. And that's the first time, if this is going to happen in the West End, that the two bodies that will make a lot of that happen, make the decisions as to whether that would happen, met together. Mm-hmm. And basically, their message was, and you were there too, I think it was, we had a lot of questions, not a lot of answers. They're almost crying or screaming for something concrete. Right now, this is all theoretical concept. And they also said, we're not going to be rushed. Give us
this. Is that because of what happened back in November, Jay, when the original proposal came
through? I think that's part of it. And, you know, there's a lot that has to go into this, and they're not going to be handed something in 5 or 10 days, say, we want a decision on whether this is going to go forward or not.
Yeah, and you have to look at it. No one said this at City Council, but the reason, too, why they're being very clear about not being rushed is back in November, when this deal was presented to them, they were told, we have to put in the bid by December, the first week of December, so you guys have to get this done now. Well, here we are, we're coming up on 6 months later, and no decision has been made. So first, City Council is kind of saying, okay, you came to us the last time with a sense of urgency, and now you guys, being FC Cincinnati and MLS, have seemed to take your time. We will be doing the same if you come back to us again.
Yeah. And I think you can also almost see that if it is going to be in the West End, if the school board goes for it and City Council goes for it, it's almost certainly going to come with what's called a community benefits agreement. And essentially, that's going to be a contract between FC Cincinnati and the city, and perhaps even a separate agreement with the school board to promise certain things. David Mann is calling for it to contain lots of specifics, and the reason he wants lots of specifics, that if the team were to fail to meet any of those specific recommendations, then they could go to court and have them enforced.
Is the biggest concern, Jay, displacement of people who live in the West End?
They talk about displacement. And the thing that I find interesting is normally when you think of NIMBY, not in my backyard, it's like for maybe like a landfill or a jail. Mm-hmm. But you're hearing a lot of NIMBY, not in my backyard, with a stadium, because literally, I think it's what, from some of these residents, it could be like 60 feet from their property line.
Yeah.
And you're going to have a stadium.
We've heard people say, the lights are going to be shining on my front yard at night, in coming through my windows, my front door. And I do think displacement is the biggest concern. The biggest question that I have is how do you put that in a community benefits agreement? Does it mean that FC Cincinnati builds affordable housing? Well, Jeff Birding's been very clear that he's not in the home building business. So it's going to be a very tricky issue as far as how do you make something enforceable as far as residents not being priced out of the neighborhood in a contract, really. That's going to be something interesting to watch if it does go to the West End.
And if you can only, and we're only making assumptions, but if City Council were to take a vote, and I don't know what Amanda thinks, I think it would be very close. And right now, I'm not sure it would pass.
Yeah, this is a different council than in November. You've
right,
three
and
new
last
members.
Time, I believe it was 5-3. One of the council members wasn't there when they voted on the Oakley funding package. But two of those council members are now gone.
Mm-hmm.
And it could be very tight.
Yeah, I agree. I think, especially with the West End, it totally comes down to the community benefits agreements. Tamaya Denard, who's one of the new council members, and Greg Lansman have been very clear that they want a pretty strict community benefits agreement. So I think that it comes down to pleasing those two with that. And I think all of council really is interested in a community benefits agreement on this issue. Wendell Young came out this he was the one that was absent during the last vote, and he came out this week and said that he would not support it in the West End period. So you're already down one vote there.
Although I did think it was interesting, he mentioned something that I haven't thought about. He was talking about, you know, he would vote for it if it were maybe in a different neighborhood, and he even mentioned Queensgate, which is
we've heard that a lot from people suggesting kind of sites over the last couple of weeks, suggesting sites that have been, you know, talked about for years.
People meaning, still talking about the garden site? Are we still hearing that?
I haven't heard that one because I think that one might be too far away from the core. And
yeah.
There were even some that thought maybe Oakley was too far away from the urban core.
Yeah, I think a lot of people have tossed out some of these sites that really could use a facelift.
Kind of like a why not question. Why not here? Why not there?
Right. And we've heard Jeff Birding say that he gets calls daily for site proposals too. But so that to me says that they're really only looking at these three sites at the end of the day.
And we can, and the longer that MLS takes to make its decision, and it keeps getting pushed out, it seems like the longer this sort of like dangling is going to continue, and probably the more turmoil and maybe not so much goodwill that will go along with it the longer it drags on.
Do we have any idea why it's taking so long?
Well, I certainly think, I know Jeff Burton came out this week and said that there's nothing wrong with FC Cincinnati's bid and it has nothing to do with that. I have a hard time believing that, right?
Already took Nashville in as their first expansion team, and then they've had this huge, because that was back in what, December was it, Jay?
They turned around, yeah. I think, within a week or two, I believe, after the bids were submitted and announced Nashville. So obviously there's three cities that are left for this one spot. There's Sacramento, Detroit, and us, Cincinnati. Detroit's kind of never really been in play seriously. And then with Sacramento, their big issue is that they're basically down a billionaire investor to make this deal work. I think with Cincinnati, it's clear that the stadium location is the issue. So you get the sense that maybe MLS is kind of waiting to see who gets what figured out first, maybe to decide who they'll pick.
Maybe it's as simple as who finds a billionaire first or who finds a site first.
Yes. It's a race.
Yes. Yeah. And you have to wonder, too, is there any holdup from the teams as well? I mean, everyone's been looking at this as an MLS issue, but we don't know what kind of conversations are going on behind the scenes. It could be that Sacramento and or FC Cincinnati are kind of pushing back with some details as well.
Jay, the $37 million package that City Council approved, that was based around Oakley, was it not?
Correct, and so, that would have to be reapproved. And that's where Council has its say on this. There's probably going to have to be zoning changes that would have to be approved, and the financing package relied on some TIF money that is specific to the Oakley area, which is TIF is a fancy word for tax increment financing, and we're not going to try to explain that in this short period of time. But anyway, it's a funding source, and it's specific to the Oakley area. And obviously, the West End is not Oakley, so there would have to be modifications.
Jay, the flooding in the area, you've been doing a lot of coverage on that. So what's the latest? We've moved into the cleanup stages now, if I understand right.
That's correct. And the Ohio River flood stage in Cincinnati is 52 feet. And before I walked in here, the river is at 52.13 feet. So it's almost back to flood stage, and that will be most of the roads around that were closed because of the flooding have reopened. In Cincinnati, building inspectors are going around. They have about 1,000 structures to review for possible damage, and they're hoping to have those preliminary assessments done by early next week. The city has opened up a temporary building and inspection location at the LeBlanc Recreation Center in the East End, because most of the damages that they're going to be looking at is in California and the East End. So folks, if they need a building permit to make repairs, they'll be able to quickly go to LeBlanc and do that. The city they haven't done it yet, but they're about ready to waive any building fees or building permit fees for that renovation work. I know Claremont County and New Richmond, they're sort of doing the same thing, assessing damage. And Claremont County has also waived those permit fees for people who need to make repairs. But everyone looks at 1997. This was clearly different than 1997. Thankfully, no injuries, no fatalities reported with this flooding as was the case in 97. And the river was just, about 4 feet under what it crested in 1997.
Jay, you did an interesting story about Harsha Lake in Claremont County. Now, I always thought Harsha was a recreational lake, but that's not the case, is it?
No, Harsha Lake actually, and a lot of the locks and dams and retention lakes along the Ohio River all resulted from the flood of 1937. And in 1938, Congress passed a Flood Control Act that provided funding and authorization to build these lakes and dams to control future flooding. And that's exactly what Harsha Lake in Claremont County is. It's a retention lake to keep water out of the Ohio River. It's about 30.
Also happens to be a nice place to boat.
Right. It has the fringe benefit of it is for recreation, but its main purpose is to help control flooding. And right now it's about 30 feet over where it would normally be. And once the river goes below flood stage in Cincinnati, then they'll begin slowly releasing some of the water that they've got held there over the next probably month by the time they get it down to the level where it would normally be in the summertime, which is about, it's either 730 or 733 feet.
Okay. How much flood damage? Do they know how much it's prevented in the past?
They don't have anything current. They gave me a brochure, and through July of 2010, at that time, they had estimated that it had prevented $87 million worth of flood damage because it was there.
Amanda, we had some allegations against city manager Harry Black this week. Computer programmer analyst Elizabeth Christensen, who worked in Cincinnati's 911 call center, has made some allegations against him. And what is she saying?
Yeah, so she had this pretty explosive exit interview that was documented in a memo, basically, that the city released this week. And in that, she, I mean, there's a lot to unpack here, really. First, there were some allegations laid out about just the mismanagement in general of the call center, saying that the person that was leading it at the time, some misspending possibly going on, some questionable spending practices with the budget, inappropriate outbursts, including swearing in front of customers, and then some, like, inappropriate touching, too. Just very unprofessional behavior. And at the time, she was working to help a software overhaul, basically, of the 911 dispatch center. This was in December of 2016. There was this meeting with Harry Black and the IT staff, which is, she was a part of because she resigned from the city last month. And during that meeting, she alleges that she tried to raise some concerns to the city manager, Harry Black, about the pacing of this software overhaul and just some general concerns she had about the staff being available to help with it. And she says that he yelled at her, threatened people's jobs that were present during the meeting, kind of if they weren't on board with this overhaul. And then after the meeting, pointed his finger in her face. As a result, she had a meeting later that day with him and two other city staffers, kind of just to smooth things over. She says he never apologized, was still kind of just never said sorry for the outburst that several people witnessed, was in front of several people. And as they went to leave, he gave Elizabeth Christensen a hug and then shook the hands of the other men that were in the room. So, again, a lot to unpack there. And this comes on the heels of some other allegations against the city manager as well over the last couple months.
Yeah. So what's been Black's response?
He responded. He did not. First of all, he did not deny that anything that she claimed in the report. He said that he did hold this meeting and tensions were very high during that meeting because there were employees that were pushing back about this overhaul and just some things going on. So he did acknowledge that. He said that he just, as far as the hug, which is what he said was most concerning to him about her allegation, the hug was just meant to, he said, kind of be a, it was a paternal instinct of his to hug her. And he did not mean it in an uncomfortable way to make her uncomfortable.
And, you know, the takeaway, the employee issues are themselves a set of issues, but for the public, you need to be concerned about the Emergency Communications Center.
Yeah, because this is not the first time we've heard about problems there.
When you call 911, if you're having a medical issue or you have a fire, your call is going into this Emergency Communications Center. And literally, I think it has had problems for more than a decade. Mm-hmm. And they tried to put it under civilian control. It was always been split between police and fire. They did away with that and brought in a civilian outsider to run it. The problems didn't get any better. They transferred it back now to police and fire, and still there are problems, and it's an important service that they need to figure out and they need to make it right.
Yeah, and that was one of the other concerning claims that she made in this exit interview, was that essentially the call center is a dumping ground for people who have not performed well in their police or fire jobs as well. That there's kind of, she suggested, a level of incompetence going on there in general. So that was, again, a lot of explosive, kind of concerning allegations made in this document.
So are there any investigations into any of these allegations? Or
so far, all we've seen is basically Mayor John Cranley directed Harry Black to write up a response to these claims, and you know, council's been a little unusually quiet, I would say, in response to these allegations.
And we mentioned that, you know, it went to civilian control and that didn't help. I know one time it was researched that there was a possibility that it would make sense to save money for Hamilton County and Cincinnati to merge their communications center to be one center. And that went nowhere because there was a difference between pay scales between county employees and city employees. And I think maybe one's unionized and one is not. I may not have that right. But there were issues, and that went nowhere. So it would be interesting to see if that pops back up on the table.
Well, and the county, I mean, to be fair, the county is dealing with some of these issues as far as people not answering the calls. Todd Portune actually talked about this in his State of the County 2 weeks ago. Because of cell phones, people will call. I mean, tons of people are calling when they see an accident. So it's there are some issues that call centers and everywhere are dealing with. But what Cincinnati is dealing with seems to be unusual.
And if we can make a public service announcement, the part of the issue of that when everyone calls, you only really need to call 911 when it's a true emergency. You know, if something is not an emergency, you may need attention, but 911 is probably not the number to call.
Amanda and Jay, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
Thank you.
WCPO.com government and political reporter Amanda Seitz and WVXU City Hall reporter Jay Hanselman. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Caney. Governor John Kasich has declared his support for tightening up Ohio's gun laws. Cincinnati Inquirer reporter Jesse Ballmert joins us now to discuss what Kasich is proposing, and you can be part of the conversation at 513-419-7100, email talk@wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Jesse, thank you for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
Jesse, where do these recommendations come from? How were they formulated?
So essentially, John Kasich got together a group of Democrats and Republicans, a lot of them former lawmakers. So Ron Magg, down from Southwest Ohio, who's a big supporter of the Second Amendment, and people like Nina Turner, who is a Democrat who now runs kind of Bernie Sanders supporting organization. And they started looking at these ideas last November and wanted to roll them out shortly after the shooting in Florida. Just some ideas about how Ohio could be looking at its gun laws, which are obviously quite important to be discussing at this particular time after this situation.
Yeah, let's go through the changes that are being proposed, and background checks. That's one thing. What are the changes that are being suggested there by this Kasich group?
Yeah, so the changes on background checks would actually be how individuals who are not allowed to have guns are submitted to this kind of statewide database, which then the federal database uses to check when you purchase a gun from a licensed dealer. It goes back and sees, you know, are you not allowed to have a gun because of a prior, you know, violent offense or, you know, a conviction for drugs or something like that. So what my colleague and I reported earlier in the week was that this is up to individual clerks of courts and sheriffs and law enforcement to report into this system, and there's really no penalties if they aren't doing it. So some of them were quite delayed in putting this information in there. And the concern is the background check system is only as good as the information that's in it. So if a felony conviction isn't uploaded, there's no way a gun seller would know that when they're, you know, running this person's background check that comes back clean. And so that's one of the things the group wants to look at, putting some penalties in for people who don't upload that information quickly.
How likely would that be to happen, Jesse, to see these penalties put in place?
So they want to give people like a period of time to get up to snuff. And then after that point, there would be some penalties. Like everything else, the details are going to be important, and we haven't seen an actual bill yet to know what those penalties would be or how long people would have to get that together. And I asked the governor this yesterday at his press conference, and he kind of said, you know, we'll work that out with lawmakers. So penalties aren't if very strict, or if there's something that isn't easily implemented, I could see you having just as big of a problem as you have right now.
Now, another one of the proposals revolves around red flags. Explain that one to us.
Yeah, this is something that a lot of people are taking a look at right now. And the general concept is if maybe a relative has a concern that a person, shouldn't have a firearm, if they're concerned like for their safety or other people's safety, they could go to a court and asked to get like a protection order to temporarily remove the firearms from that person. This came up after Florida because there were a lot of kind of warning signs that this guy perhaps, you know, could have been violent and so forth. So this is actually something that Democrat Joe Schiavone, who's running for governor, had proposed. He's currently in the state Senate. And so, but talking, I spoke with Buckeye Firearms Association yesterday, and this is something they're very concerned about, you know, the potential taking away of somebody's guns and how that would happen and would they have due process in that.
And how often do mass shooters, like what happened in Florida, there were a lot of red flags there, but how often do mass shooters exhibit warning signs?
Well, it's hard to say. Different groups have different estimates. I think one stat I saw was about half of the time, but it's hard to prove the negative, like what didn't happen in some of these situations. But I think a lot of times when we see these mass shootings, everybody goes back and says, oh, look, like they had a prior domestic disturbance or so-and-so was afraid of them. And kind of after the fact, everything seemed to, you know, look like this was inevitable. So who really knows? There are about five states that have this red flag law right now. One of them is Indiana. And it's just been kind of hard to tell whether these laws are effective because so few places have them, and it's not something that's gotten a lot of testing.
You mentioned domestic violence. What is the Casey Group proposing when it comes to domestic violence?
Yeah, so right now the federal law is that a person who is convicted of domestic violence, even a misdemeanor, kind of a lower level or first offense, would not be allowed to purchase a firearm. Also, if they were subject to a protection order because of domestic violence or allegations of domestic violence, they wouldn't be able to purchase a gun. And so what Kasich and his group would like to do is bring Ohio's law to say the same thing, essentially. And there are a number of these proposals that are essentially mimicking what federal law already does. And so the difference would be like local police could investigate and charge you for this as opposed to the FBI or ATF having to do it.
There's also another proposal that he had dealt with armor-piercing ammunition. That's already illegal. A lot of that's already illegal under federal law, isn't it?
Yeah. So this is another one of those things that there's a federal law for, and so it's questionable, like, how much value is there to have a state law as well. But I spoke with the U.S. Attorney's Office on this, and they essentially said there are some types of armor piercing ammunition that is illegal, kind of like your more military grade stuff. But there are a lot of bullets that can pierce armor that don't even fall under the federal prohibition or anything like that. So I think we're kind of waiting to see what exact bullets or ammunition would be banned under this proposal from the governor.
And they also had a proposal on straw man purchases. First off, if you could explain what a straw man purchase is and then what the Casey Group is proposing on that, Jesse.
Yeah, there's actually a rather unfortunate example of it that happened recently in central Ohio. If you're aware, there were two Westerville police officers who were fatally shot. And the man who is accused of shooting them had a gun, but he wasn't allowed to have a gun because of a prior felony conviction up in the Cleveland area, but he essentially is accused of asking a friend to purchase the gun for him and maybe gave him like some extra money to do this transaction. And so the friend would be what we would call a straw man, essentially somebody who purchases a firearm knowing that the person they like intend to give it to is not allowed to have one. And so the friend who purchased the gun in the case of the Westerville shooting is actually charged under federal law and could face up to 10 years incarceration from that.
And again, this is something that's already under federal law as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So again, it would be one of those things that's taking federal law, putting it in Ohio law, and the effect of that is local police could investigate instead of federal officials, the assumption being that maybe local police have more time or resources to do that. I don't know if that's actually accurate, but that's the gist.
Jesse, did any of the proposals address bump stocks?
Yeah, there is one that would bring Ohio's law in line with whatever the federal government does on bump stocks. And bump stocks, which were used in the Las Vegas shooting, essentially allow a semi-automatic weapon, which is legal, to act like an automatic weapon, which is illegal. And so a lot of people, I believe even the NRA at one point after this,